Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Gina Baleria, the Associate Director of Programming here at the club. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Philip Zimbardo, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Stanford University and author of The Lucifer Effect and his latest, The Time Paradox, The New Psychology of Time That Can Change Your Life. Dr. Zimbardo is considered one of the top psychologists on the national and international scene. He is best known for the 1971 Stanford prison experiments, which illustrate how social situations can influence behavior in ordinary people. In fact, his expertise in this area led to his serving as an expert witness for a soldier in the Abu Ghraib prison abuses. Dr. Zimbardo began teaching at Stanford in 1978. Prior to that, he taught at Yale, NYU, and Columbia. And he is currently on the faculty of the Pacific Graduate School of Psychology and the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. He brought psychology to everyday people through his PBS series, Discovering Psychology. And in addition to the two books mentioned above, Dr. Zimbardo has authored 48 others, including the oldest still current psychology textbook, Psychology and Life, currently in its 18th edition. He served twice as president of the Western Psychological Association and was also president of the American Psychological Association. He has recently taken the position of executive director to the Center for Interdisciplinary Policy, Education, and Research on Terrorism at Stanford. And he has been honored numerous times for his work to advance and serve the profession of social psychology, including most recently the Vaclav Havel Foundation Prize for his extensive research on the human condition. Please welcome Dr. Zimbardo.
It's wonderful to be at the Commonwealth Club again. I had a wonderful reception last time I was here talking about the Lucifer Effect. I'm going to talk about something very, very different tonight, something I think which has a more direct application to your lives. What I'm going to talk about is the secret power of time, how time influences your personal decisions and even national destinies. Our usual focus on time is clock time, or objective time, that records time's passage in minutes, seconds, hours. But we're going to look at a different kind of time. It's subjective or psychological time that we each create in our minds to delineate events that are significant to each of us. And for each of us, that subjective time is slightly different. I was in England recently, and there was a sundial at Castle Howard that in addition to recording the passage of time through the shadow of the shadow makes the sun's shadow on this time dial. There were also some messages around that sundial. Time by moments slips away, first the hour, then the day. And then there was a grim reminder of our human mortality. It says, on thine eyelids is the shadow of death. Therefore, live your life wisely and well, and also probably good. So time perspective, one definition is that it's the psychological study of how we divide the flow of human experiences, our personal experiences, into different time frames, or if you will, time zones. And we do it automatically without thinking about it. And the goal of my presentation tonight is to get you to think about it so you can develop the optimal time perspective. Now, these different time frames or time zones vary between cultures, between social classes, and between individuals. And what I'm going to say, which is unique, is that they become biased in that you tend to overuse one or two of them and you tend to underuse one or two of them when the ideal is to balance flexibly to be able to use each of the time zones I'm going to talk about. I make an extraordinary claim that time perspective is one of the most powerful influences on all of human behavior and also the destiny of nations. And the paradox is that if this time perspective exerts such a powerful influence on us, how come we don't know about it? And I'm saying we, meaning us as lay people, but also psychologists have, very few psychologists have studied this phenomena. It's not in any textbook that I know about. And so for me, it's curious. I've been studying this for many, many years. I'll describe why in a minute. And I do think that I'm going to try to demonstrate tonight that your sense of time perspective influences almost everything you do. And as I said, it does it automatically. And the critical thing is now bringing that up to level of consciousness so that you can begin to decide, do I want to live with this time perspective bias or do I want to modify my bias? The book I wrote with John Boyd is called The Time Paradox. It's a book which claims it'll help you reclaim yesterday, enjoy today, and master tomorrow. And ideally, it can change your life. Unlike most, it's not a self-help book, but it has a lot of practical advice. But it's advice based on 30 years of research that I've done at Stanford and other colleagues who work with me have done. I think it presents these ideas in a scientifically sound fashion. So your life is filled with many decisions you make every single day. The most basic one is, are you going to work or are you going to play? Are you going to study or go out with friends? This is every student's concern. Are you going to drink more wine before driving home? Are you going to enjoy sweets knowing you're a diabetic? Are you going to practice safe sex or just do it? Are you going to smoke more now, risk cancer later? Are you going to vote for Obama's change versus to keep the status quo? And ideally, 52% voted for one and 48% made the other decision. And the most critical thing is, are you going to give in to temptation or delay gratification? So how does your time perspective influence these and hundreds of decisions you make every day, little ones and big ones? Well, the model I'm working with is that you have to make a decision now. All decisions are in the now, in the moment. And based on the decision you make, you're going to take some action. And the question is, what influences that thought process and that action process? For some people, it's only things in the immediate situation. What does it smell like? What does it taste like? What does it look like? What is your body telling you? What is your biological, are your hormones getting running around crazy? Is your testosterone rising? But also, what are other people doing in that situation? So for some people, it's the social element around that situation, it's the physical element, and it's the physiological element. And most of their decisions, whatever those are, that whole list, are going to be made only focusing on the immediate situation. And we're going to call those people present-oriented if that's the dominant way they approach decision-making. Now, the next person sitting next to you makes the same exact decision, any of those on that list, and ignores the immediate situation because they focus on the past. They begin with, when was I in this situation before? What did I do? How did it work? What does this remind me of? And so memories determine their decision. And there are some people whose decision process is always based on bringing the past into the present. And they minimize all of those things that present-oriented people are focusing on. Now, there's a third person. And this third person doesn't focus on the past, doesn't focus on the present. Every decision he or she makes is, what are the anticipated consequences if I do A versus B? What is the probability that it'll work out? And so their whole life is organized around costs versus benefits. And people who tend to make all their decisions focused on anticipated consequences, we're going to call them future-oriented. Now, what's interesting, although it seems very different to be past-oriented versus future, what's similar is they're both abstractions. They are constructions of the human mind. They don't exist. The past and future exist only one place, in your mind, and they are open to lots of construction and fallibility. But I'm going to talk about them as if they were types, I mean, present-oriented, past-oriented, future-oriented, because it's simpler. But in fact, it's a continuum. That is, people have varying degrees of past, present, and future. So you could be a future-oriented person with a little bit of a present orientation and moderate amount of past. And we're going to see in a moment that each of us really has a profile of at least five different levels of time perspective. So a psychologist at Stanford, Walter Mischel, did a simple study some years ago with nursery school children, 4 years old. He played a game with them, and the kids won the game, and they got a treat. And the treat was a marshmallow. They said, you could eat this marshmallow, but if you wait until I come back, you're going to have two. So is a bird in the hand worth two in the bush? I mean, you got it. You know it's going to be true. Or does it make sense? If you like one, obviously you wait to get two. Well, it turns out some kids waited and some kids didn't wait. Okay? And the kids that waited, I'm going to call them reflective. I'm going to call them future-oriented because they resisted the immediate temptation, the way the marshmallow looked, imagining how good it's going to taste. And what they were doing is creating a future-oriented scenario in which two marshmallows are going to appear, and they're going to enjoy it twice as much. Well, what's interesting about this simple decision is that Walter Mischel went back 14 years later, when the kids were now 18 years old, tracked most of them down, checked their school record, did interviews with people who knew them and the kids. And these two kids, the kid who delayed versus the kid who was impulsive, are now totally different adults. If you think of 18-year-old kids as an adult. Now, I have a simple animation I made, and I'm not sure how well it's going to play without the sound, but I'll try my best.
You may already be familiar with the famous marshmallow study conducted by my colleague, psychologist Walter Mischel, in which a group of four-year-olds were given one marshmallow and told they were allowed to eat it immediately. They were told that if they could wait to eat the marshmallow after being left alone with it for a while, then they would be given an extra marshmallow to eat. Most eat the marshmallow as soon as they are left alone with it, but some other children are able to resist temptation. Those children who ate the marshmallow right away are considered to be oriented toward the present, while those who resisted temptation have an orientation toward the future. When the children were interviewed years later as 18-year-olds, there were amazing differences between the children who were able to delay gratification and those children who couldn't resist the immediate temptation. Scored 250 points higher on the SAT, overreacts to frustration, works well under pressure, indecisive, self-reliant and confident, prone to jealousy and envy. The marshmallow experiment is a classic study of how a person's ability to delay gratification, even at the age of four, can predict many significant future outcomes. But what does this have to do with you? A lot. In my new book, The Time Paradox, you will learn how your own relationship to time plays a significant role in your personal happiness. Whether you're looking for a better understanding of the world at large, from religion to politics to business to national destinies, or want a deeper understanding of yourself, The Time Paradox teaches you how to recognize your own attitudes toward time and how your everyday decisions are influenced by your personal time orientation. And it will help you overcome the hidden mental biases that keep you too attached to the past, unhealthily obsessed with future goals, or too focused on immediate gratification. You can improve your personal success, happiness, and psychological health. The Time Paradox will show you how. It's only a matter of time, making time work for you.
Well, now, where do we get these learned biases? I mean, where do they come from? Why is it that I'm excessively future-oriented and you might be excessively present-oriented, somebody else might be excessively past-oriented? Well, it turns out the reason it's automatic is there's so many things that influence it. Culture has a huge influence. Geography and climate, the closer you live to the equator, the more present-oriented you are. The more you live in a climate, in a culture that doesn't change, being future-oriented involves being aware of change. Religion, we'll talk about that in a moment. Protestants are more future-oriented than Catholics throughout the world. Social class, middle-class people get to be middle-class because they become future-oriented. Lower-class people tend to be present-oriented. Education in most cultures moves you more toward being future-oriented or past-oriented. If you grow up in an environment which is politically or economically unstable, you do not develop a future orientation. Because a future orientation involves trust. Trust in people. So when this guy says, I'll give you two when I come back, suppose he comes back and says, I lost them, or I got held up, or I forgot. Well, if that happens enough times, kids lose trust in adults, or kids lose trust in authorities. So it's going to be interesting as we're moving into this period of incredible economic instability, whether we're going to have a shift of many people toward being present-oriented. Well, we also learn it from family, from being around people who are mostly in one of those time frames. And we learn it, and it's a function of our psychological developmental stages. So I'm going to argue in a minute, we all begin as present, little present hedonists. And over time, some of us stay there, but others become more past-oriented or future-oriented. Women tend to be more future-oriented than men in all of our research. And as you get older, interestingly, you become more present-oriented because the future is death. present-oriented in the sense that you really want to selectively optimize your social choices. My colleague Laura Carstensen has this notion of selective optimization of emotional context, so that if you have a choice to be with a celebrity or an expert in some area, most people, or a friend, most people say celebrity or friend. As you get older, you want to be with a friend rather than a celebrity. And it turns out the same thing is true in research she did. If you're a graduating senior at Stanford, you want to spend time with your friends rather than some celebrity. If you're a junior or sophomore earlier, then friends are less important than being with celebrities. I developed a scale, which is available for you, and I'll give you the website to take it, in which we look at six different time perspective zones. The past and present get divided into two. You can be focused on the positive things in the past or the negative things, and that's very, very different. You can be present hedonistic or present fatalistic, and we'll talk about each of these in detail in a minute. You could be future-oriented, focused on life goals, but another way to be future-oriented is life begins after death for people, certainly people in some religions. We call this the transcendental future. What we leave out is what I call the holistic expansive present. It's the Zen experience of now. And that's neither hedonistic nor fatalistic. And again, most Zen meditation exercises try to get you in the moment of now, not to focus on the past, not to focus on the future. And there's a wonderful piece in the Sanskrit that says, yesterday is already a dream and tomorrow but a vision, but today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness and every tomorrow a vision of hope. So let's look at these five time perspective measures. The transcendental scale is a separate one, which is also available both in the book and online. And if you go to www.thetimeparadox.com, the scale is there. You can take it and you can score it automatically. Plus, we have lots of articles that we wrote that are available for free. So when you take this scale, there are a bunch of items, and some items are, it gives me pleasure to think about my past. I like family rituals and traditions that are repeated regularly. If you answer strongly, that's characteristic of me, then you're going to qualify as past positive. On the other hand, some people answer these questions. I've taken my share of abuse and rejection in the past. Painful past experiences keep being replayed in my mind. That qualifies you as being past negative. So for some people, the past is remembering the good old days, remembering nostalgia, the joys of family ritual, holiday feasts. In countries that are pre-literate, the past is preserved by storytellers. And the stories are always about the glories of the past, the glories of the ancestors, because in part they want the kids to become the next generation's heroes, to take the place of the elders. But what's important about being past positive is you're linked to the generations through that past orientation. You have a sense of continuity of who you are over time, and you have a sense of family links and family tradition. But not everybody has a great past. Suppose your past was traumatic. Lots of people have had abuses, rejection, failures, and lots of people, even if they haven't, remember or over-remember the negatives. Those people get trapped in a negative past, and they recycle that negativity. Psychological, clinical depression comes out of that. And in fact, a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder, and we're seeing a huge amount from veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, even more than from Vietnam. And partly, they have one foot in the past negative and one foot in the present fatalism. And as long as they're stuck in the past, they can never be cured. And I have a colleague, Dr. Sword, who's working in Tripla Veterans Administration in Hawaii, who after hearing my talk is now using these metaphors in therapy to have vets with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, think about why one foot is stuck in the past, one foot is stuck in the present, of the experience that led them there, and what are they going to do to take one or both of those feet and put them in the future time zone? And he's saying that simple change of thinking is having remarkable effects. On the scale, you could also answer, I do things impulsively. I try to live my life as fully as possible, one day at a time. If that's your answer to many of these kind of questions, you're going to be present hedonist. On the other hand, people say, fate determines much of my life. Since whatever I do will be, it doesn't really matter what I do. Que sera, sera. And we're going to those people qualify as present fatalist. So I do things impulsively, making decisions at the spur of the moment. These research at Stanford, these are kids who don't wear wristwatches, don't make to-do lists, gamble and luck rules over hard work. But we all start life there. We start life as present hedonists at the breast or at the bottle. We act without planning for consequences. And so one of the major causes of childhood death is accidents. Those kids, you know, see something attractive and go for it and then figure out how am I going to get down from the top shelf. But also one of the things of childhood is in most societies we indulge children, we let them play. And play is for fun and immediate gratification. You don't play to learn leadership skills. You play because it's fun. The moment it stops being fun, it becomes boring. And when something is boring, you stop doing it, and you try to do something which is exciting and novel. The great thing, the singular best thing about being present hedonistic is you have more friends than anybody because people like to be with you, like to be around you because you're a party person, you're a fun person. You're there in the moment. In fact, you're like a child. Video game excitement traps adolescent boys in the present moment. And now you don't have to go to an arcade. Any kid who can afford $200 can be trapped 12 hours a day sitting around his own video game. Time stops in gambling casinos where there are no clocks, no windows. And the people who design them want to trap you in that moment to get you excited in that moment. People will bring you drinks. People will bring you food. They just want you to stay at the roulette machine or whatever the gambling machines are. What's terrible about being present hedonistic is all addictions are the disease of present orientation. Drug addiction, gambling, food addiction, sexual addiction. Because all addictions are great the first time. And then you die, okay? Well, then you get sick. Then you go to hell. But, you know, what nobody says, I mean, it is a high to take drugs the first time. It's a high to have wonderful sex. It's a high to eat, you know, some delicious, I'm thinking of pizza with a banana split. Those are wonderful. The problem is when you do it the second, third, fourth, fifth time, then it becomes an addiction. The main way we deal with drug and alcohol addiction is a program called DARE, Dare to Say No to Drugs. Program doesn't work at all. At least 7 recent studies done. It doesn't work. It doesn't work because it doesn't recognize their audience. The reason those programs, plus all our propaganda, all our advertising against cigarette smoking and alcohol and drugs, is they focus on the future negative consequence. If you do this, then here's this bad thing. And they work for future-oriented kids and people. But they're not the kids who get addicted. The kids who get addicted are present-oriented. That's the target audience. And also all those messages focus on inner dispositional determinants, willpower. That's not what it is. The key is they don't recognize the powerful situational social forces that trap present-oriented kids. If everybody else is doing it, they're going to do it, no matter what commitment they made, no matter what game they played in their class to say no to drugs. So it says you have to understand who is your target audience. Your target audience is not kids. It's present-oriented kids because they are the ones who are vulnerable to addiction. And you have to design propaganda messages. You have to design role-playing that fits the way they process information. So what keeps us all from becoming present hedonists? Well, we go to school. Education is a rescue. And one of the arguments is, cynical argument, education is about transforming hedonistic, present-oriented beasts into kids who will obey authority, sit in their seats patiently, tolerate endless boredom, to become future-oriented workers of the world, because most jobs that we prepare kids for are going to be boring jobs, and we want them to do the job without complaint. Just in case school doesn't do the job, we add parables, stories, models, games, anything to crush those present-oriented desires for having fun, playing, and not wanting to work hard and becoming a boring adult. So the story of the three little pigs, which is a story in almost every culture, is a morality tale about time. The pig who They know the wolf is around, but one pig says, "I'm going to have fun. I'm not going to bother. I'm going to just throw a house up a straw." And of course, when the wolf comes, he eats him. But his brother shows the virtue of planning and hard work, which are exalted in the three little pigs. Builds his house of bricks. Takes a lot of time when the other one's having fun. But when the wolf comes, he huffs and he puffs, and he can't blow his house down. And for girls, the Cinderella is a morality tale about time. It says, at the moment of your peak experience as a woman, the most important thing is you got to remember time. At 12 o'clock, you go back to being the servant girl. And she almost doesn't make it. Of course, they have a happy ending because the prince finds her. But in Sicily, and I'll talk about that in a minute, where people are much more present fatalistic, a graduate student told me that her grandmother used to tell her the story. And at the end of it, she would say, "And they lived happily ever after." She says, "That's them. For us, nothing changes." She goes back to being a servant. And that's what it means to be present fatalist. And again, when we give girls dolls, we don't want them to play with the dolls. We want them to imagine a future of being a mother, a future of motherhood. So each time perspective future scale item, you answer the following. I believe that a person's day should be planned ahead each morning. Meeting tomorrow's deadlines and doing other necessary work comes before tonight's play. I'm able to resist temptations when I know there's work to be done. So what are the temptations? Well, sex, drugs, rock and roll, all the things that are fun, all the things that are playful. There's an ad I saw in an in-flight magazine, a sexist ad that says you can't mix business with pleasure. And there's a woman in her bikini trying to tempt her husband or boyfriend not to go to work. He's got his attaché case. And the question is he going to yield to that marshmallow pleasure, or is he going to go about his business? And they say if you go to this hotel in Cayman Islands, you can do both. You can have your work and eat it too. I was in Moscow recently, and they have this wonderful cemetery in Red Square. And the thing that struck me most, there's a huge mausoleum, a huge marble monument with this businessman. And what's striking is he's on the phone. And so his family had to pay, you know, millions of rubles to erect this thing as a monument to this guy who always had to make one last call. And here he is, one last call. Operator, give me Jesus on the line. I want to close this business. Brad Klunz from University of Hawaii said that he's doing survey research, and the single best predictor of individual wealth of males is the extent of complaints by family of not being available to them, of not being there for them. He said, of all the things that you predict, grades and so forth, he said, this stands out. And it turns out, a study done in Palo Alto, over 4,000 male executives, middle managers who are relatively successful, these are people 40 to 60 years old, they say, in looking back over my career, the words I use to describe it are empty and meaningless. That is, it's not what they set out to be. Even if you're successful, it means you make a lot of money, but the particular job you do is not changing the world in any better place. It's, you know, you're a vice president of some toilet paper company, and you know, people are having a softer rub because of you, but that's not what you set out to do when you were idealistic. So everybody gets 5 scores, and now what we do is, we go to College of San Mateo, and we give hundreds of students our scale, plus a dozen other scales. And we're going to correlate. We're going to see what is the association with each of those scales. If you're future-oriented, what does that correlate with? And the other scales are things like depression, anxiety, aggression, focus on concern for future consequences, happiness, things of this kind. And there's a statistical measure called a correlation coefficient. And it's an index. It's a number that indicates what is the degree of association between any two scores, any two variables. If the score is 0, it means there's no relationship. And the correlation go from +1 means it's a perfect relationship. If you get a high score here, you're going to get the same high score in the other scale. Or a negative perfect relationship, if you get a high score here, you're going to get the lowest score there. In psychology, most of the correlations are actually around 0.2 or 0.3, either positive or negative. And so what's striking is, the data I'm going to show you is we have extraordinarily strong correlations. So here is future time perspective. And the outstanding character trait of people who are high on future orientation is conscientiousness. The correlation is 0.70. That's as high as a correlation gets in psychology. These are people who prefer consistency. They have ego control. They have a lot of energy, and they control their impulses. What they are low on is low on sensation seeking, low on aggression, low on depression. Now, the amazing thing is, after we did this, there's a study just came out in health psychology by Friedman, UC San Francisco. He's the one who came up with the concept of type A personality. And what he did is he analyzed 20 different studies of 9,000 people that reveal conscientious people live longer in many different nations, of course, many different studies. And now we know why. Because our people who are future-oriented practice positive health behaviors. They get medical checkups. They get dental checkups. They floss their teeth. They eat healthy foods. They exercise. They wear seat belts. And they avoid risky behaviors. And I'm going to present the data in a moment. They don't do risky behaviors on bikes, on cars. They don't seek sensations. They don't practice unsafe sex. They don't do drugs and alcohol. And they don't get into arguments and fights. So here's this correlation, just an association. Correlation never means one thing causes the other. So if you're future-oriented, you're going to be conscientious. And the reason you're going to live longer, and that's the ultimate measure, you know, ultimate outcome measure, is that you practice positive health behaviors and you avoid the negatives. If you're past positive, it's a very different profile. You're happy. You have a positive self-esteem, you're friendly, you have some level of energy, some creativity, but again, you're low on anxiety, depression, and aggression. Look what happens if you're present hedonistic. The world is totally different. This is a different person. Their highest scores are novelty-seeking, sensation-seeking. Again, 0.70. High on energy, high on aggression, high on creativity. Low ego control. Ego control is minus 75. They don't care about consistency. They don't care about controlling their impulses. They're negative on conscientious, and they don't have emotional stability. The sad thing are the next two. Now, remember, these are students who are functioning students. It's not a clinical population. These are students who are going to school, going to work, you know, having relationships. And students at College San Mateo are slightly older than standard students. Probably the mean age of in the sample is probably 22 or 23. If you are a present fatalistic person, your outstanding characteristics are aggression, anxiety, and depression. Low level of concern for the future. You don't care about it's minus 70. Low self-esteem, low conscientiousness, low energy, low emotional stability, and negative unhappiness. That is a sad profile. In fact, my argument is that that this scale should be given routinely in schools, because it now will identify in advance students likely to develop depression, students likely to become shooters, high school shooters, because this is a profile of a high school shooter. Well, all you have to add here is, he gets dad's gun. And the other bad thing is people who focus on the past negative. Anxiety, plus 75, aggression and depression are extraordinarily high in these people. And they have no sense of self-esteem, no emotional stability, no impulse control. They're not happy. They're not energy. Those two are sad profiles, and nobody has ever pointed these out. And I'm saying these look like, if I said, you know, we looked at a mental hospital, and here's these patients. No, these are functioning students, and so they deserve our attention. What I'm going to argue is each of these time frames have, even in the extreme, present hedonistic, present fatalistic, past, have positives, but also in the extreme they have negatives that outweigh them. So if you're past positive, you're happy, you have self-esteem, you're patriotic, you have gratitude, this is where wisdom comes from, you love family values, and you have a sense of personal identity. If you're present hedonistic, what's good about that? What's good about being present hedonistic? Now, getting out of control. Let me just go back in. It refuses to go back in time. If you're present hedonistic, you're high affiliated, you take joy in life, you're sensual, sexual, you have a lot of energy, you're good at improvisation, and you explore novelty. So corporations need these people, because these are people who are going to be creative. These are people who are going to think outside of the box, because they always think outside of the box, because their job is never to be in the box. If you're future-oriented, you're high achievement, you have high self-efficacy, you have a health focus, You think in terms of probability. You think in terms of cost-benefit analysis. You think in terms of expectancies. I want to argue the reason that a lot of low-income kids do poorly in school is because they are present-oriented or past-oriented, and school is about thinking in terms of probability and causality. Nothing in school is immediate. Everything is delay of gratification. And so I'm going to argue kids do poorly in school not because they don't have the intelligence. It's because they are living in a different time zone. School's all about being future-oriented. And if kids come in from a family, from a community that which is present or past-oriented, that's going to be a handicap. What's bad about being stuck in the past negatively, this is where trauma is. This is where guilt is. This is where depression is. This is where retaliation and revenge is. These are wars that are going on throughout the world because several hundred years ago, your great-great-grandfather, tribe attacked my great-great-grandfather, and so we need blood revenge. As I said, what's wrong with being present hedonistic is that's where all addictions come from. They take risky actions. They have a lot of violence and anger. This is where all the gamblers come from. This is gambling. And this is the credit card debt. The billions of dollars we have credit card debt in America is from these people. And they believe you make gains in life through luck and not effort. My father was one of these people, present hedonistic. And he didn't care if he worked or not. And he would always, and I'd say, Dad, why don't you do this? I'm looking to pay for jobs. He said, no, I'm waiting for my ship to come in. I said, Dad, there are no ports in the Bronx. There's no ports in the Bronx. The ship can't land here. You got to get a job. What's wrong about being future-oriented? This is where anxiety is. Anxiety is worry about the future. This is where worry comes from. The extent to which you become heavily focused on the future, you become socially isolated. You give up. We'll show you in a moment. Family and friends. You become very competitive. And at least for men, this is where a lot of sexual impotence comes from because sex is another performance. It's another performance on which you're going to be evaluated. And once you think about sex as a performance on which you're going to be evaluated, then it's all cognitive and not biological. And so you need the Viagra. Now, John McCain, for example, is a wonderful instance of a fully functioning person stuck in the past. In his first debate with Obama, what he said is, my opponent and I agree that we want to bring the boys home. The only difference is I want to bring them home after we win the war. That's the mentality of an old warrior. What he fails to recognize is the war on terrorism is called an asymmetrical war, asymmetrical conflict, which means it's a nation against individuals or networks. There is no one to surrender. You cannot win a war unless there's someone to surrender, and there's no one to surrender. So who is the enemy in Iraq? It's al-Qaeda, but al-Qaeda is not, there's no one to surrender from al-Qaeda, or it's the insurgents. And so to leave Iraq, essentially, is going to be some other thing. It's not winning the war. It's going to say, we have achieved a sufficient level of security that allows us to leave. We then use this scale in various studies around the world. So we show that women in Rome are more likely to visit a breast cancer clinic for annual checkups if they were future-oriented, but not women who are present-oriented. Brazilians and Mexicans were more likely to support efforts of environmental sustainability and water conservation the more future-oriented they were than present-oriented. We give students at Stanford mazes to solve, males and females, and half of them are present-oriented, half are future-oriented, and we say, go. If they're future-oriented, they don't go. They look. They look at the goal. They look at the start. They look for cul-de-sacs. If you're present-oriented, you go. You just start moving a pencil through. And the consequence is 90% of the future-oriented students solve the maze, and only 60% of the present-oriented solve the maze. That's a huge 30% significant difference. But suppose future-oriented people simply practice mazes more. How are you going to eliminate past experience? Maybe there are people who play puzzles more. So what we do is we get future-oriented kids at Berkeley, and we hypnotize them, and we make them present-oriented. Under hypnosis, we say the past and future are distant and insignificant. The present is expanding. And when you do that, you get the same effect. At Berkeley, the future-oriented kids 30% more likely to solve the maze than kids who were future-oriented who are now thinking as if they're present-oriented. Who smokes, takes drugs, drinks alcohol? We did a huge study at Stanford and Cornell with over 1,200 students, and Stanford males, Stanford males and Stanford females were identical. The more present-oriented you were, the more you used alcohol, the more you did risky driving. And it's true in Cornell, it's true here. Turns out it's the same with women. Nobody's ever separated out women by time perspective. Because in general, you say, you know, men take more risk in life, men drink more. Females at Stanford and Cornell who were present-oriented had even higher correlation in terms of alcohol use and risky driving. So let's look in the world. These are students. Let's look at heroin addicts, hospitalized heroin addicts compared to controls in the hospital. Heroin addicts were significantly more present hedonistic, more present fatalistic, and significantly less future-oriented, and there was no difference on past. So here's a pattern that you see, you know, when somebody comes, is an addict, it's time perspective that's pushing in this direction. Who takes risks? We surveyed... trying to get back in time. We surveyed high school students about risky behavior. Taking risks driving, driving while drunk, racing, or wearing seatbelts. The high school students who were more present-oriented had highly significant positive correlations. The kids who were future-oriented, it was the opposite. The correlations were negative. The more future-oriented you were, the less likely you were to take risk driving, the less likely you drove while you're drunk, the less likely you raced, and the more likely you were to wear seatbelts. In a different group of high school students, what we found is if you're present-oriented, you're more likely to watch R-rated movies, more likely to watch X-rated movies, more likely to have sex. You're more likely to watch MTV. You take risks on your bike, and you do skateboard tricks. And what's important is if you're present-oriented, all of those correlations are positive. I mean, the more you are present-hedonistic, the more likely you are to do these things. If you're future-oriented as a high school student, it's exactly the opposite. The more future-oriented you are, the less you are likely to do these things. I'm going to skip a foot. Okay. So, the optimal time perspective is to be moderately high on past positive. You don't want to be extremely high because then you're stuck in the past, because then you don't like change. You like status quo. Moderately high on future, because then you're going to be a high achiever. You're going to set goals. You're going to develop means to get to those goals. But you don't want to be extremely high because you're going to sacrifice too much for that. And you want a dash of present hedonism because that's where the fun comes. And you want to be low on present fatalistic and past negative. The past gives you roots to connect to your identity and your family, to be grounded. The future gives you wings to soar to new challenges and destination, and the present gives you energy to explore people, places, yourself, and sensuality. The problem is, after you think about that, and I'm going to tell you, you have to think about how you can flexibly shift from those time zones depending on the demands of the situation. So if you got to get work done, you suppress the past thing, you suppress calling home, you suppress, you know, watching what's on television, playing a video game, and you get the work done. But when the work is done, you say, I deserve a reward. I need a hot tub, I'm going to get a massage, I'm going to call up friends, go to a coffee shop, have a beer, open the good bottle of wine. And then you say, let me call grandma, let me call my mother, let me connect to the past and the present. The problem is Americans are saying we have no time. In cities large and small throughout the United States, people say we don't have enough time. We are pressed for time. USA Today did a survey 20 years ago called The Time Crunch. They asked Americans a whole series of questions. And in general, what they found is people said, I am being crunched. This is 1989. So some of them said, I'm so busy that I brush my teeth while I'm showering. I dress my kids the night before so they'll be ready for school. I won't have to do that in the morning. And the poll asks, what ticks you off? What makes you angry? Waiting for late people, being caught in traffic. 85% get upset people are late. But waiting in line, waiting at a doctor's office, low restaurant service, waiting for the government to act, waiting for a repair, just waiting gets people crazy. And so We're going to buy products and we're going to use services that save time. So if there's any young people in the audience, if you want a career, if you want a marketing skill, develop something that saves people time. So this is 20 years ago, microwaves, mail order catalogs, bank machines, answering machines, personal computers, all of these things, and now all of these are now off the scale in the current survey. But the big question is, when you're busy, what do you shortchange? What do you give up? 71% of Americans then said, I give up household chores. I don't invite anybody in, so who cares what my house looks like? 60% say, I give up recreation. 56% I give up hobbies. Half say, I stop watching television. I don't care about that. I care that 46% say, I don't have time for friends. 41% say, I don't have time for family. 10% say, I don't have time for schoolwork or jobs, and they are the kids who flunk out or people get fired probably. Obviously, the ad agencies picked this up. There was an ad for Quaker oatmeal, instant Quaker oatmeal for moms who have a lot of love but not a lot of time. And this mother says, my son is a very picky eater, but in 90 seconds, I can make him this oatmeal that he thinks is really good because he never tasted real oatmeal. So what does he know? but the ad reflects the sense of, you know, you want to be a good person, but you don't have the time. And so how can I do it? So Quaker oatmeal says you can do it in 90 seconds. So the problem is that time hangs us up. I got USA Today to redo the survey this year as the 20th anniversary, and they surveyed 2,000 Americans in a web-based survey. 70% said, I think of myself as busy or very busy. 50% say, and I'm busier now than I was last year. Okay. Even worse, 60% said, I get angry now for late people, traffic, slow services, but a new thing, 30% said, I get angry because my computer takes so long to boot up, and it takes so long for the web to download, like, you know, sometimes a whole minute. And even worse than before, 45% say, I sacrifice friends, 30% say, I sacrifice family, and 57% of Americans say, I sacrifice sleep. Now, this is not broken down by being future-oriented present. This is all people. We're analyzing the data now. I'm sure that these figures are going to be much more extreme for future-oriented people. 90% say, I wish I had more time to spend with my family and friends. So I asked them a question. Suppose they gave you another day. What would you do with it? Okay? So the answer is, if you had another day, only 9% would spend it with friends. Only 31% would spend that day with family. Only 25% said I'd spend it having fun. Mostly they said I'd get more work done. There is something wrong with our society. Our society is becoming time-driven, in part because the boundary between work and home life has dissolved because of the computer, because of technology. So we bring our work home, or some of us work home all the time, But we are now driven in a unique way, and that we are willing to sacrifice friends, family, sleep, and fun. And that's a recipe for disaster. And I'm going to argue that time makes you better because you have the capacity to set your priorities in whatever time zone you're in. And the key for me is the three Fs, making time for family, friends, and fun. So very quickly, as I said before, one of the big influences on us is culture. Protestants are more future-oriented than Catholics. That comes out of the Calvinist revolution, in which you were allegedly predestined to go to heaven or hell, and the index of where you were going, the signal was your worldly success. So that motivated people to work really hard to be successful here so that it would be a sign to everybody that I'm going to heaven. Well, that's where the Puritan ethic came from. That's where the work ethic came from. That really is the fundamental basis of capitalism. As I said, social class and economics, lower class people are more present-oriented than future-oriented people. And again, around the world, if you look at gross national product, gross national product is higher the more people in any culture who have a strong future orientation. In 2002, only one of 50 loans were subprime. This year, one of three. That's, for me, the extraordinary statistic about the situation we got into. High-risk subprime. So it's not that a few. Everybody was doing it. And the argument I want to make is that meltdown was really caused by motivated collective greed. That here are people who are usually wise, future-oriented decision-makers who know you need reserves, who know you have to be cautious about some loans and mortgages, and they traded that in for short-term, present-focused, quick gains. They fail to discount future costs against the immediate taste of the marshmallow. They are like those little kids who said, I'll take one now. I don't care about the future consequences. It's really an instance of what we call the commons dilemma. In California, we know about that. We know about that because we have a city called Monterey. Monterey was the center of sardine industry. And every day, fishermen would go out and they'd fish all the sardines they could. And all the fishermen kept doing that, and people kept saying, you know, there's a limit to the resource. You can't keep doing it. And one day, some fishermen fished the last sardine out of the ocean. And there are no sardines in Monterey Bay. So this is the common dilemma. Each individual is working out of a competitive, selfish orientation. But when the resource is limited, as many of our resources are, then that's where you need regulation. That's where you need cooperation. That's where you need someone to be the future-oriented decision maker. My colleague Robert Levine has written a wonderful book you might want to look at called Geography of Time. And he looks at different cultures. And he says cultures have different time zones. You know, and we make fun of it. We call it, you know, Mexican time or black time or Italian time. That almost always means present hedonistic time. So if I gave a lecture in Ixtapa, Mexico, that's supposed to begin at 2, nobody was there except me and two other people at 2, two Americans. And the Mexican, these were psychiatrists and psychologists, professional people. They kept coming in from 2:15 to 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock was the end of the lecture. And they didn't sneak in. They, hola, Zimbardo, how are you? And essentially, the problem was the lecture was at 2 o'clock. People were still having lunch because it started at 12 and lunch went to 2 or 2:30 or 3. And so in many cultures, the time zone is totally different. Unless you're aware of that, a lot of what you think of other people as irresponsible, of lazy, of childish, and it's true in a family. I want to argue a lot of family conflict comes from being unaware that you have different time zones, the husband, the wife, and the kids. My family comes from Sicily, and there it's focus on mostly the positive past with present hedonistic, but no focus on the future. In fact, I discovered in Sicilian dialect, they don't have a verb for the future. It's was, is, there's no will be. So that's why nothing gets done. I mean, nobody does the planning. And in fact, here's one instance of how time perspective affects national destiny. One more. In Italy, there's a movement to separate. Divide Italy in half. People from the north, there's a political party called the League, and what they've done is they say people in the south are like children. They have babies, they have 3-hour dinners, they don't want to work, they're lazy, and we work hard, and we pay the taxes for them. And in a recent election, they got 14% of the national vote to divide Italy in half, North Italy and South Italy. And essentially, it's a time war. Those in the north are influenced by Austrians and Germans. Those in the north, all the industry in Italy is in the north. All the big companies are in the north. There's no big companies in the south, in part because of the mafia. Mafia controls unions, mafia extorts. And so it's not that people are lazy, don't want to work. There is no work for them to do. But again, people instead of being aware that here are these fundamental time perspective differences, focus on negative attributes of the other. So I want to end with, if I can get my computer to. Okay. Essentially then, what I've tried to do is give you a quick and dirty overview of what time perspective is, how we measure it. And as I said, it's in the Time Paradox book. There's much more of the research that I've just alluded to today. But again, if you go to the timeparadox.com website, you can take the scale. You can read about a lot of this research. And I think that understanding how time perspective influences you at as a personal level, as well as you and your family and your community, you can begin to make changes, and you can begin to change your attributions of other people as lazy, as indifferent, all the things we say negatively about other people. If you simply say, oh, I understand now, they're present hedonistic, or they're present fatalistic, or they're excessively future-oriented. And it's possible to make these changes. And it influences us in many ways. So, for example, Or it should influence as many. I've had lots of surgeries, at least seven. I had my hips replaced. I had carpal tunnel syndrome, rotator cuff tear. And in all of these, you have to go to physical therapy. Half of the people in America who start physical therapy never finish. And what that means, in some cases, the problem gets worse. So if you have rotator cuff tear, the simple exercise is you got to walk your fingers up the wall. And you know what? It hurts. And it hurts worse every level you go up. And if you quit, as many people do, you develop scar tissue and you're never able to raise your hand again. And who are the people who are going to quit? It's got to be present and past oriented. Because the only reason you keep doing something which is painful is you have a vision of a future scenario in which you have your mobility again. And so being aware of, maybe, we don't know, this is a hypothesis, maybe the people who quit, the people who don't continue, if we could identify when they start therapy, who are the present-oriented, future and past-oriented, and that means those people need special attention. They need somebody calling. They need a routine thing on your phone, on your cell phone, on your computer, which says, you got to keep doing it, you got to practice, I'm watching, I'm listening, and so forth. And so it leads to different ways of dealing, same way with this kind of problem. Because to recover from some illness requires hope. Hope is a vision of a better, different future. And if you don't have that hope, so if you're present fatalistic or past negative, you don't even start with any. But I'm saying even if you're present oriented, if it hurts, you stop. You don't do things that are pain. You only look for pleasure. And so I'm saying, as with addiction, by understanding the basic text that people are using, that you modify your approach, your educational approach, your rehabilitation approach to fit the situation. It's not easy to change time perspective because all these things have propelled you to be where you are today. And I'm going to end with this. My whole family was a present hedonistic. Father, everyone lived in the present. Nobody even went finished high school. I became future oriented because I had teachers who said, you know, you're a smart little kid, you got to study, you got to work hard, here's assignments. And everything was orderly and predictable, and I loved school. And I became more and more future-oriented. But at some point, I became excessively future-oriented. I became all the things that I'm making fun of here. Essentially working all the time, day and night. And at some point, I said, too much. And that I stepped back, and that's one of the reasons I got interested in this whole thing, is how do I put more joy in my life. Joy in my life is more present hedonism. How do I reconnect with family that I had given up? Family was one of the things I sacrificed for my career, even before I got to Stanford. And so I can honestly say I've begun, and it's not hard, it's not easy to do, I've begun to try to develop this balanced time perspective in myself. And my life is much richer and much fuller and much more enriching for me and then also for the people around me. So it's possible. I'm a case study in process. It's not over yet. And I hope you can do it too. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Zimbardo. I remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're pleased tonight to have Dr. Philip Zimbardo talking to us about his new book, The Time Paradox. And if you'll pardon the pun, we have time for a few questions before we run out of time.
Any timely ones, though.
But we had a good time. I have a lot of questions here, and what I'm going to do is consolidate as many as I can. Several of them are about the election. And they come down to question, did you notice in the election, as the candidates were trying to appeal, particularly to the independent voters, any characterization of that demographic as either present, past, or future-oriented?
Yeah, that's a good question. Obama's whole campaign was about the future. I mean, from the very beginning, it was about change from something to something else. And what the campaign was built on, saying that where the Bush administration has taken America is not a place where most Americans want to be, and we need a change from that. And it was explicitly about hope, about change. Yes, we can. It's not even clear what. Yes, we can do something. And I think what Sarah Palin brought to the table is a kind of present hedonism. I mean, in her manner, in her style, and I think a lot of people resonate to that. I mean, present hedonistic people are instantly likable. I mean, she's there. Part of being a media personality is you connect to the audience, especially one-on-one or in television. And McCain, unfortunately, kept slipping back and forth. He was never centered on. I think he had to make a deal with the Republican Party in order to get the nomination. If you remember, he was his primary, and suddenly one day they announced everybody's pulling out. Mitt Romney, everybody's pulling out. So it had to be some deal. They said, we're going to give it to you because while Hillary is fighting against Obama, we can solidify and organize. And once they gave him that treat, then he had to conform. He had to say, yes, I'll do this and this. He had to take Sarah Palin when he wanted Lieberman or someone else. And there were a number of things he did which I think trapped him between the thing. So at some point, if you remember, at some point in the middle of the campaign, they tried to take over Obama's slogan, say, you know, we can change or we look ahead. Well, they didn't really believe that, so they dropped that. So in a campaign, the thing about Obama was his campaign managers were brilliant. I mean, they took the best of Karl Rove's campaign tactics and brought it to a new level by using young people who really knew technology, who really knew the power of the web. And that's what's unique in history in this campaign. So I think there were these differences in time perspective of the candidates, but also I think of the way they're, in quote, strategists or handlers arrange things for them.
Another line of questions is, you've observed the variations in time perspective among different personalities. To what degree are these inherited traits versus ones that we would call nurtured or learned?
Yeah, I'm a social psychologist. I believe more things are learned than are inherited. There's just no evidence that people are born with one of these things. We're born present hedonistic only because that's the survival mode. Namely, you're born seeking sustenance, you avoid pain, and you seek things that are pleasurable. You like sugar rather. So built in is, you know, a preference for sweet. You like sugar and not bitter things. So there are clearly some things built in through nature. I mean, a lot is built in through nature. But I think time perspective is really such a complex psychological phenomenon that I want to argue it's really learned over time. It's learned, again, growing up in a particular middle social class, growing up in a particular culture, at a particular era, you know, with family who are all present-oriented or family who are mostly future-oriented. So if you grew up a kid in a future-oriented middle-class family, it's not a decision whether or not you'll go to college. That's a given. The only question is which college. If you grew up poor, it's a major decision, you know, are you going to finish high school? And if so, are you going to go to college? And how are you going to get into college? So the family structure in those cases organizes the way you think about your future. I mean, so the only issue is which college am I going to get into, not should I go to college. Of course you have to go to college.
Is there a median personality profile you would describe along the spectrum? Because you describe past, present, or future personality types, but how would you say that our society is distributed among the three?
Oh, we don't. That's a good question. We haven't done. Although I said I've been doing research for 30 years, we have not done national samples. We have not done really large surveys. I can say, you know, this percent of Americans are past, present, or future oriented. In general, it's the future oriented people who run the machine. They're the ones who, you know. are the innovators. They're the ones who, you know, head the corporations, lead innovation technology. Most people who are workers are more likely to be present-oriented or past-oriented. I think certain religions encourage more of a past orientation than other ones, as we said, a more Protestant religion. But even within Protestant religions, evangelicals are different from Episcopalians in this sense. What's interesting in the book, I didn't have time to cover it, is we have a whole chapter on this transcendental future that we did research looking at people from different religious backgrounds, different racial backgrounds. And one of the most interesting things is I had never realized Jews don't have the Christian sense of hell and heaven. Jews don't live for life after death. And so they don't have a transcendental future. I mean, it's not I'm preparing my life so when I die, you know, when I go to the pearly gates, it's going to be wonderful. St. Peter, whoever's going to be there, Allah is going to open the gate. They said, no, you got to do it now. You got to do good now. You have to serve your country. You have to serve your family. And it's in the present. And maybe that's one of the reasons Jews tend to be very high on philanthropy, to try to make the world better now rather than wait till after they die.
To what degree, either using your terminology or their own constructs, is a psychiatric and social therapist type community adopting some of the concepts that you've introduced here?
Well, that's a good question. The answer is not at all. let's just step back and talk about how does time perspective fit into different therapies. So, Freudian therapy is really all about having people understand that your current symptoms are a manifestation of early childhood conflicts. And psychoanalytic therapy is about making you aware of things you have repressed, suppressed in about your past and making you aware of what that is. So it's primarily focused on having you discover the negatives in your past. So it's really a past-oriented therapy. Existential therapy and a lot of the current focus on more positive outcomes is really very future-oriented. It's, you know, imagine an ideal self. Imagine, you know, an ideal future self, future scenario that you will move toward. Cognitive behavior therapy, which is the dominant one, certainly practiced by clinical psychologists, focuses on the here and now. It says, you know, what are your symptoms that are distressing you, that are upsetting your life, that are leading to dysfunctional behavior style, and what's reinforcing them, and what do you have to do in the present to change those? So essentially, if you go to three different therapists, a Freudian, you're going to be focused on the past. A cognitive behavior therapist, you're going to be focused on the present. And an existential therapist is really focused on more on the future. But so far, none of these, I think our research and the book is too new to yet have any impact in therapy. But as I said, what I am convinced of is early identification of people who are high on past negative and present fatalism in order to do remedial work before those traits develop into psychiatric symptoms. I think that, to me, that's a no-brainer. That's really important.
You showed the Quaker Oats ad, which really was oriented towards saving people time, you know, faster booting computer, et cetera. On a broader level of product marketing, do you see advertisers differentiating the methods by which they will try to market a product based on the presentism or futurism of use?
That's a great question. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, sophisticated advertisers always understand, you know, what drives human behavior. I mean, they understand unconscious motivation even without knowing about Freud. And my sense now is, I mean, I don't look at enough ads. I don't analyze ads. Actually, my daughter Zara does. She focuses on media literacy. But it has to be that a sophisticated person who's developing advertisement we'll know about these different time perspectives. Now, the problem is that, you know, how do you tap into different markets? So if you're focusing on teenage market, where it's going to be a heavy present hedonistic element, then you want to have ads which are bang, bang, dramatic, dominant, with loud music and things happening in all the ads, the TV ads for these new video games are exactly that. I mean, you know, things are exploding all over the place. And I think for most future-oriented people, you don't want that. I mean, the ads have to show you that if you do A, then B is going to follow in a predictable way. Let me just, we also asked high school kids to give us a description of their ideal mate. And summed across a bunch of kids, students who are high on past zone, both positive or negative, said their ideal was dependable. Kids who were future-oriented wanted their ideal mate was somebody who was predictable. And kids who were present-oriented, their ideal mate was exciting. So even at a high school level, they are looking at the world through three different lenses. And I'm saying, so a sophisticated ad agency would pick this up and work it into their ads against us to get us to buy things we don't need or want.
Let me remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California and Dr. Philip Zimbardo. We have time for one more question, and it's a combination of two, really. Part one is, why are people chronically late? And B, why does it bug me so much?
It bugs you so much because you're future-oriented. If you're present-oriented, you don't care because you're one of the people that's chronically late. But punctuality, that's a whole other interesting aspect of this, is punctuality. What does it mean to be late? Again, this is culturally determined. I mean, if you're a business person, you have an appointment. If you're a minute late, you're late. It's assumed you're going to be there earlier. And that it's a question of also status. The higher status you are, the more you can keep people waiting longer. And the higher status you are, you expect people never to keep you waiting. But I think it's a sense in which time is, you know, time becomes a commodity if you're future-oriented. You know, time is money. So, and what you hate is wasting time. So if somebody is late, they're wasting your time. You're sitting doing nothing while you're waiting for them. And that's almost certainly in Calvinist orientation, that's a sin, you know, to waste time. But as with my example of my lecture in Mexico, you know, people came in whenever they felt it was appropriate. Or, for example, if you go to Bali, on any night of the week, there is a performance, a play, a song, a dance. Because in Bali, they wed art and culture and religion. And so you're an American. You go to the hotel keep and you say, you know, when does the performance begin? He said, tonight. And you say, what time? He said, well, you know, in the evening. You say, 8 o'clock sometimes. He said, well, what do you mean? Sometimes it begins earlier. How early? Sometimes 7. It's never late. Sometimes 9. He said, how will I know when to go? He says, no, you just go, and it will begin or it won't begin. And sometimes it doesn't begin at all because the performers don't feel like performing. And then you go home, and you come back the next day. And Americans, we get crazed. You say, we want it to begin on time. We want it to begin at a particular time. And essentially, actually, in Indonesian, the word for time gets translated into literally rubber time, that time is stretched to fit human affairs. In our culture, people are squeezed to fit a time zone. And so again, the people who get crazed about this are, if you're future-oriented and you don't realize you're dealing with somebody who's present or past-oriented, for whom time is not as important as you. It's not a commodity. It's you're there in a reasonable time. You're there, you know, around 8 o'clock. You know, what's the difference? This was also a big problem in the military with minorities, especially naval personnel, the boat pulled in, and they had the weekend off, and they went home. They went to Oakland. They went to places. They were having fun, and they had to be back at a certain time. And they got back within an hour or two, and they got sent to the brig Because if you're an hour late, you know, that is, you're breaking the rules. And essentially it was, you know, we were having fun, and the train wasn't running, the subway wasn't running, BART wasn't running. And so again, then we begin to say those are irresponsible people. So that my main concern is, if we understand people's time perspectives, then we stop making these negative attributions. They are irresponsible, they are lazy, they are indifferent, they're callous, et cetera, et cetera. Or they're nerds, which present hedonistic people think about us future-oriented people.
Thank you, Dr. Zimbardo, for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
Our Commonwealth Club evening is adjourned.
Thank you.